Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Dan Friedel. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Today on the program, Dan Novak and Faith Perlow let us know that learning does not stop when you are young in this week's Education Report. After that, Gregory Stockel tells us that the American Library Association is concerned about book and information restrictions at school and public libraries. Then, Ana Mateo joins us for Words and Their Stories. She tells us about some American sayings related to important buildings that were used to hold valuable goods in past years. And finally, Kelly Jean Kelly brings us the next part of our series on America's presidents about James Monroe. Now, here's Dan Novak with the Education Report.
For those attending classes at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, or OLLI, in Washington, D.C., retirement is not a time to slow down, and it surely is not a time to stop learning. OLLI, which is on the grounds of American University, AU, offers classes especially for retirees. The Institute has more than 90 classes each semester and has about 1,600 members, or students. It costs just $300 per semester, or $550 for the spring and autumn semesters. OLLI offers its members classes in 10 different fields. The courses for this spring include the history of slavery in America, the ancient Mediterranean, color theory, playwriting, and the ups and downs of weather. Classes meet once a week for 7 to 10 weeks. I think the typical OLLI members were the kids who were most excited about school, said Tony Long, OLLI's executive director. They love education. They love learning. And these are people who, for the most part, retired at the height of their respective professions. OLLI at AU is one of 125 Osher Lifelong Learning Institutes on college campuses nationwide. The programs started back in 2001 with financial support from businessman Bernard Osher's foundation. And in 2008, the Osher Foundation provided a $200,000 gift to create OLLI at AU.
OLLI at AU is considered to be the most demanding program in the country, Long said. Much of it has to do with the OLLI membership in Washington, D.C., said Penny Hansen. She has taught a course at OLLI on the Supreme Court for several years. The nation's capital is known as a city with many knowledgeable people in law, politics, public policy, and media. A lot of people retire in Washington and just stay here, Hansen said. They really like it here because it's a stimulating environment here. Unlike some teachers at OLLI, Hansen had no official teaching experience before OLLI. She also does not have a law background. But she spent 30 years at the Environmental Protection Agency, helping carry out the agency's programs. Hansen said she became very interested in the Supreme Court after retiring, and after taking classes at OLLI for a few years, decided to teach one. I did not know 80% of what I'm teaching now. When I started out in Ollie, she said. What I bring to this is the larger view of being out in the world and understanding government and how people view and approach government. She said she prepares for her classes, which are largely about recent Supreme Court cases, by reading many books and reports. This semester, there are 7 lawyers taking the class. The class is not designed for people with a strong legal background, but Hansen said it does not bother her that there may be people taking her class who know the subject better than she does. Kevin Mills is a recently retired business lawyer in Hansen's class. He said he had long been interested in issues of constitutional law, but I didn't really have the time to focus on it as much as I do now. He added, I can dig deeper now that I have more time.
Long said that at Ollie, the relationship between student and teacher is more equal than at a traditional school. The idea is that everybody who comes into the room has knowledge and experience, he said. It's going to add to the classroom discussion. Throw that in with no grades or test, and it's a good combination for taking classes. Sarah DiCarlo was taking the class on the Supreme Court for the second time. My degree was in speech pathology, so I didn't get a chance to take a lot of these liberal arts courses, she said. At Ollie, she has taken classes on music, movies, and history. When do you get a chance to do that? She asked. DiCarlo attended the class with her friend Mary Sue Flanagan, whom she recently persuaded to join. Flanagan said she had previously audited classes at a different university and greatly enjoyed the experience of being with younger college students. Auditing means attending a class, but not for credit. But she said to take a class with the experience of someone like Hansen and with your contemporaries is just a totally different dynamic. I'm Dan Novak.
And I'm Faith Perlow.
I'm Dan Friedel, and you're listening to the Learning English broadcast. You just heard Dan Novak present the Education Report. Dan joins me now to talk more about the story. Welcome, Dan.
Great to be here.
Dan, I wanted to ask you about a word that comes up in the story, stimulating. What does that word mean?
Sure. Something stimulating brings about great excitement or interest. For example, a stimulating book is so good you don't want to put it down.
How is it used in the story?
One teacher I interviewed, Penny Hansen, said that many people who retire in Washington, D.C. stay in the area because it is a stimulating environment. And as someone who has lived in D.C. for almost my entire life, I agree. It's one reason why I've stayed here for so long. D.C., the nation's capital, is known for having a pretty smart population. Because this is a center of government, many legal experts, political experts, and writers come to live here. When you have such a smart and knowledgeable population, it creates an intellectually stimulating or exciting place to be. And to come back to the story, the city helps create a stimulating classroom environment at Ollie. Everyone at Ollie I spoke to talked about what interesting classroom discussions there are. And the Ollie at American University is known as the most academically demanding Osher Lifelong Learning Institute in the country. Dan, I know you lived in Washington for a long time as well, but now you live in Cleveland. What do you find stimulating about Cleveland?
Well, Dan, I grew up in Cleveland, and I was away for almost 30 years. But I stayed a fan of the sports teams here, so I got a chance to go to one of the important baseball games last October, and the home team, the Cleveland Guardians, won in the last inning with a home run. That was pretty stimulating. Thanks for coming on the show, Dan.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
The American Library Association, or ALA, released a new report Thursday about book banning in the country. It found attempted book bans and information restrictions at schools and public libraries continue to increase, setting a record in 2022. The report says there were 1,200 known challenges in 2022. That is almost double the number from the year before, and it had also been record-setting. The ALA began collecting the data 20 years ago. "I've never seen anything like this," says Deborah Caldwell Stone, who directs the ALA's Office for Intellectual Freedom. She said the last 2 years have been frightening, tiring, and angering. The report also says the way restrictions are requested has changed. A few years ago, challenges were usually from parents and community members concerned about an individual book, the ALA says. Now the requests are often for several removals and organized by national groups, such as Moms for Liberty. Their goal is unifying, educating, and empowering parents to defend their parental rights at all levels of government. Last year, more than 2,500 different books were objected to, compared to 1,858 in 2021 and just 566 in 2019. In many cases, hundreds of books were challenged in a single request. The ALA bases its findings on media accounts and voluntary reporting from libraries. It says the numbers might be far higher. Librarians around the country have told of being harassed and threatened with violence or legal action. Caldwell Stone says that some books have been targeted because of racist language, but she says the majority of requests for removal are for works with LGBTIQA+ or racial themes. Bills easing the restriction of books have been proposed or passed in Arizona, Iowa, Texas, Missouri, and Oklahoma, among other states. In Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis has approved laws to review reading materials and limit classroom discussion of gender identity and race. Books removed in Florida include John Green's Looking for Alaska, Colleen Hoover's Hopeless, and Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale. DeSantis has called reports of mass bannings a hoax. He said earlier this month that some people are attempting to use our schools for indoctrination. Some books do come back. Officials at Florida's Duval County Public Schools were widely criticized after they removed Roberto Clemente, the Pride of the Pittsburgh Pirates. It is a children's book about the late baseball star from Puerto Rico. In February, they announced the book would again be available, explaining they had needed to examine it and make sure it did not violate any state laws. I'm Gregory Stockel.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. A fort is a place of protection. It is a fortified structure with strong walls and doors, complex locks, barriers, and other security features. It is used as a defense. It is a place often protected by soldiers and occupied by officials. Someone always is in charge or responsible for a fort. And that is where our expression comes in. If someone asks you to hold down the fort, you are responsible for a place while those who supervise it are away. In other words, you are in charge. You are the chief. For example, once a friend and I were at my house preparing for a party. But then I got an emergency call from my brother, who needed a ride. So my friend held down the fort at home and welcomed party guests while I helped my brother. Sometimes we just say, hold the fort. This also means staying behind to take care of things. Again, whoever is holding the fort is in charge. They are responsible for what happens, and they may be responsible for the safety of others. For example, Marion is the most responsible of the group, so we left her at the house to hold the fort. There is another way we use the word fort in an expression. In the American state of Kentucky, there is a famous fort, Fort Knox. Fort Knox is a protected place in the United States. Why is it protected? Fort Knox is a place where lots of gold is kept. Needless to say, it is heavily guarded. So, when we want to describe a place that is hard to get into, we can compare it to Fort Knox. A place that is, like Fort Knox, is inaccessible, usually because it is locked or heavily guarded. We can also say a place is as safe or as secure as Fort Knox. Now, let's hear these two expressions used by two friends.
Hi, Sam. What brings you to my place?
Well, Maxine is holding down the fort at home, so I thought I'd stop by to see if you want to hang out.
Sure. How about a walk around the neighborhood? I feel like I've been sitting all day.
Sounds good. Let's walk past that construction project down the street.
They've been working on that house for months. I'm curious about the renovations.
Maybe we can sneak into the place and look in the windows.
That's a really bad idea. The property is locked up tighter than Fort Knox and probably has many security cameras. If you sneak in, you're on your own.
And that's all the time we have for this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. James Monroe easily won election in 1816. He had a relaxed, likable personality and was popular with voters. In addition, many saw him as a last connection to the country's founding generation. Monroe had fought in George Washington's army during the Revolutionary War against British rule. He was a diplomat during Thomas Jefferson's presidency and helped complete the Louisiana Purchase. Monroe served as James Madison's Secretary of State and briefly as his Secretary of War as well during the War of 1812. Voters' positive feelings carried Monroe into office and defined his presidency. When Monroe became president, the United States had just declared victory against British forces in the War of 1812. The American economy was also doing well, at least at first, and the government was mostly united under a single party. But Monroe did have one immediate problem. He and his wife, Elizabeth, could not move into the president's house right away. The British had burned it badly in an attack on Washington, D.C. Workers were busy making repairs. So Monroe decided to go on a trip. He spent the first weeks of his presidency traveling. He went north into New England, visiting important places from the Revolutionary War or the War of 1812. Everywhere he went, he reminded Americans of their shared, proud history. He even wore clothes in the old colonial style. One of Monroe's nicknames is the Last of the Cocked Hats. Then President Monroe turned west, toward lands that white migrants were increasingly settling. They were able to move west in part because American soldiers had defeated a powerful alliance of Native American tribes. What had been a victory for the U.S. government was a crushing loss for Native Americans. Many tribes moved farther west. Others began to lose their languages and their customs as white settlers took control. For Monroe, however, the visit west was a positive sign of the country's expansion. By the time he returned to Washington, Monroe had met many Americans. He had learned for himself the geography of the country, and he had demonstrated that all parts of the U.S. could be connected by patriotism and a common federal government. One newspaper called Monroe's presidency the beginning of an era of good feelings. 4 years later, Monroe won a second term even more easily than his first. Yet James Monroe's presidency had several crises. One was the country's first economic depression in more than 30 years. Another was over slavery. The country had been divided over the issue since its founding. By the end of 1819, 11 states, all in the South, permitted slavery. 11 states, all in the North, did not. The question became, would the new states in the West permit it? Monroe had to face the question when settlers asked Congress permission for Missouri Territory to become a state. Many enslaved people already lived there. White settlers expected to bring more. But a member of Congress from a northern state proposed that Missouri could become a state only if it banned slavery. That proposal started a debate that lasted more than a year. For the most part, the debate was not based on the moral problems with people owning other people. Instead, it involved economic and political concerns. Northerners argued that slaveholding states had an unfair economic advantage. In addition, if Missouri entered the Union as a slave state, its lawmakers would move the balance of power toward the South. The debate continued so long that another area asked to enter the Union. People in northern Massachusetts wanted to organize into an independent state called Maine. After some time, lawmakers offered a compromise. They said Maine could be admitted as a free state and Missouri as a slave state. But they also made a line across a map of the country. They said Congress would not admit another slave state north of that line. James Monroe signed into law what became known as the Missouri Compromise. It settled the issue of slavery, at least officially, in the U.S. for more than 20 years. But everyone knew that the peace between pro-slavery and anti-slavery groups was only temporary. In 1823, Monroe made one of the most important foreign policy decisions in American history. It became known as the Monroe Doctrine. It related to Spain's colonies in Latin America. Monroe had dealt with Spain before. In his first term, he and his Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams, successfully negotiated with Spain to buy Florida for the United States. By Monroe's second term, Spain had also lost control of some of its former colonies in Latin America. The president became concerned that Spain's European allies would try to help the country regain power. He did not want European powers interfering in areas so close to U.S. territory and so important to U.S. trade. So Monroe gave a speech to Congress. He said, the U.S. would stay out of Europe's affairs. But, he said, Europe should also stay out of Latin America's affairs. And Monroe declared that European powers would not be permitted to begin colonizing any area in the Western Hemisphere. In other words, Monroe declared that the U.S. considered the entire Western Hemisphere its sphere of influence. Historians note that Monroe did not aim for the Declaration to be a major statement, but it became a base of American foreign policy and supported U.S. expansion throughout the 19th century. James Monroe was the fourth and last president in the Virginia dynasty. Except for John Adams, four of the first five American presidents were from Virginia. Monroe and his wife returned to their home there after he left office. They had a close relationship with each other, as well as with their two surviving children, both daughters. Unlike many politicians of his time, Monroe had brought his family with him on his travels. He also believed strongly in education for girls. When the Monroes lived in France, young Eliza Monroe attended the best school for girls in Paris. This loving family spent as much time together as possible. So, when Elizabeth Monroe died, James Monroe was filled with sorrow. His health also began to fail. He moved to the house of his younger daughter, Maria, in New York City. James Monroe died there 1 year later at age 73. Like two other former presidents, Monroe died on the 4th of July, America's birthday. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's the Learning English broadcast for today. Thank you for listening, and thanks to all my colleagues for their work on the program. I'm Dan Friedel.